So last week we started the first chapter in the Yoga of Divine Works, as it was ultimately titled. Chapter one is the Four Aids. Sri Aurobindo wrote this probably in December of 1914. It was published in January of 1915, on the 15th day of the month. And he noted that there were four great instruments that had to combine to make the integral yoga successful: the teaching, the shastra, the personal effort, utsaha, the power of the teacher, the guru, and finally, the time that it takes to accomplish this mighty transformation, kala. Now, it's interesting to note that Sri Aurobindo had written a kind of a monograph, something more than a notebook, in 1912, which, after the Arya ceased publication, came to public's attention in 1921. It was published as the Yoga and Its Object. The next year, it was reissued as the Yoga and Its Objects, plural. Sri Aurobindo did not attach great importance to it, but if you read that thing that was written in 1912, you see that he refers to these same four elements and instruments in the practice of yoga there. It's a beautiful book, and even if he regards it as an early phase of his thinking and not reflective of his full yoga, still, it is something that in many of its passages is powerful. He refers in these four elements to a passage in the Mahabharata, you know, that great story of India, the epic. There's a section in the Udyoga Parva, chapters 41 through 46 cover it. And it's the section called Sanat Sujatiya. It's about the sage Sanat Sujata, who is one of the four mind-born sons of Brahma. Dhritarashtra, who is the king of the great realm in which the Pandavas and the Kauravas are beginning to have such disagreement that they will arrive at war. And Dhritarashtra is looking at this bleak future. He who has no sight is regarding this bleak future and is speaking with his counselor, Vidura, who is himself a great sage. And Dhritarashtra is looking for ultimate comfort, and so wants to know the nature of the universe. What is all of this about? Why is there suffering? What is death? And he wants to pose these questions to Vidura, and Vidura says, "I'm the son of a Shudra. I can't answer these questions for you. But I can summon a sage who can." And so he calls Sanat Sujata through the power of his mind. And so the sage appears, and the king can ask him the question. And M.P. Pundit put this very beautifully in his talks. "Sage, is there death or is there not death?" And the sage answers, "There is death and there is not death. Death is heedlessness. Death is inattention. When you are not conscious, you die. If you are aware of your consciousness, then you live. And then the sage goes on to share these four great steps, these four instruments that one can use to assure that you awaken to your own immortality. Shastra. And it isn't here meant, and it isn't meant by the sage in the Mahabharata either, that it is the mere scripture, the written down or the spoken word communicated from generation to generation. Precious though those things are, the abode of real knowledge is within. The divine word is transcendent, it's true, but it is immanent. All things potentially can be our teachers, can be the instruction to us, and also it is in us. In the very spark of our souls lies that same thing, if we will access it. So Veda and Upanishad, each is a denotation of that eternal. The Veda, the supreme knowledge, is, as Sri Aurobindo said, secret in the heart of all beings. It exists there, not in English or in Sanskrit or in any language, but it is the eternal word, the very vibration of manifestation that arises from the divine supreme consciousness. And what are you if not a spark of that creativity? So first we have to recognize what is the nature of the teaching and where can we find it. Within, in the core of our soul, above, in the transcendence, speaking to us through universal experience, if we listen well, if we listen with the third ear. So you can download for free, I believe, the Mahabharata in some form or the other, and you can go to the Udyoga Parva, chapters 41 through 46, and read that great dialogue between the king and the sage, who, after he finishes speaking and saying that this divine is everywhere, that this is an immanent reality, that this extraordinary, excellent insight will lead you to liberation, then he disappears from the scene. And the king has then, of course, to absorb this knowledge and use it, because he can see what will be the fate of his 100 children. So, on to the next step, the four aids. We talked about Shastra last week. This week, we talk about Utsaha. The development of the experience in its rapidity, its amplitude, the intensity and power of its results depends primarily in the beginning of the path and long after on the aspiration and personal effort of the sadhaka. Now let's go back right above where the stars are and look at the final sentence of the previous section. The rest, following the teaching, the rest depends on personal effort and experience and upon the power of the guide. So the development of the experience in its rapidity depends on the aspiration and personal effort. Years later, when Sri Aurobindo begins to pull his ashram together, he announces that if you want to succeed in the integral yoga, aspiration, rejection, and surrender form the triplicity that will carry you there. Aspiration is always key. Aspiration takes you, because of its intensity, to the experience that you seek. The application of that aspiration, the application of will, is what comes next. The process of yoga is a turning of the human soul from the egoistic state of consciousness, absorbed in the outward appearances and attractions of things, to a higher state in which the transcendent and universal can pour itself into the individual, mold and transform it. From the earliest chapters of The Life Divine and the Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo has made plain that true being is not simply an ocean of unpartite, unmanifest, absolute being, but that it is a transcendent, it is a universal, it is an individual truth, that all these three terms give us the complete picture of what being is, of what Brahman can be. So, even if we find the truth of the individual and realize our inner soul and its power, its beauty, its felicity, it isn't enough if we stay there. We have also to broadcast our consciousness into the world and discover there the same reality that lies within us. So if we begin with the discovery of our soul, we have also to experience the universe as an extension of the same divine being, of the transcendent as the ultimate source of both universe and individual. So to achieve any of it, to find soul or cosmos or transcendence, we have to get out of the experience of the ego. The ego is a way that we individuate our consciousness, discover what we might be, become aware of ourselves. But too fixed a notion of what we are in this limited bag of skin with these few thoughts and a couple of passions, you know, this is hardly the definition of what we are in our greater being or what we might be as we develop. So the first thing is that we have to be willing to give up this scanty self that we call the ego. The first determining element of the siddhi, of the perfection, is therefore the intensity of the turning, the force which directs the soul inward. The power of aspiration of the heart, the force of the will, the concentration of the mind, the perseverance and determination of the applied energy are the measure of that intensity. The ideal sadhaka should be able to say in the biblical phrase, "My zeal for the Lord has eaten me up." It is this zeal for the Lord, utsaha, the zeal of the whole nature for its divine results, vyakulata, the heart's eagerness for the attainment of the divine, that devours the ego and breaks up the limitations of its petty and narrow mold for the full and wide reception of that which it seeks, that which, being universal, exceeds, and being transcendent, surpasses even the largest and highest individual self and nature. So, utsaha, what is strong, utsaha, we begin our chant, sahana vavatu sahana, so let us be strong. Utsaha. But this is only one side of the force that works for perfection. The process of the integral yoga has three stages, not indeed sharply distinguished or separate, but in a certain measure successive. There must be first the effort towards at least an initial and enabling self-transcendence and contact with the divine. Next, the reception of that which transcends, that with which we have gained communion, into ourselves for the transformation of our whole conscious being. Last, the utilization of our transformed humanity as a divine center in the world. So the transcendence into union, the receptivity in us of the responding transformative power, and then standing as a divine center of action in the world. And of course, we can see how this gets extended into the life of the ashram a dozen or so years later. Because that is its ideal, that community that formed around him was to speak to the world of what the possibility of a divine humanity might be. So long as the contact with the divine is not in some considerable degree established, so long as there is not some measure of sustained identity, sayujya, the element of personal effort must normally predominate. Sayujya, united in being. But in proportion as this contact establishes itself, the sadhaka must become conscious that a force other than his own, a force transcending his egoistic endeavor and capacity, is at work in him, and to this power he learns progressively to submit himself and delivers up to it the charge of his yoga. In the end, his own will and force become one with the higher power. He merges them in the divine will and its transcendent and universal force. So you note that this line, the sadhaka must become conscious that a force other than his own is redolent of what he writes in The Mother in 1928. So these themes that are being built and expressed in the aria, and of course later he's gone through and substantially revised these as they're coming out, reach in a way their acme of expression in that little book. So if the first phase was transcendence, here he's talking about the transcendent acting in the aspirant. So this is about the second phase. Again, in the end, his own will and force become one with the higher power. He merges them in the divine will and its transcendent and universal force. He finds it thenceforward, presiding over the necessary transformation of his mental, vital, and physical being with an impartial wisdom and provident effectivity of which the eager and interested ego is not capable. It is when this identification and this self-merging are complete that the divine center in the world is ready. Purified, liberated, plastic, illumined, it can begin to serve as a means for the direct action of a supreme power in the larger yoga of humanity or superhumanity, of the earth's spiritual progression or its transformation. So again, it is something we have to become aware of, the actual action of the divine power affecting the transformation within us. We need to be able to be aware of it so that we can work in co-agency with it, that we can collaborate with it, that they can become one strong conscious partnership. And two, the second aspect, when he speaks here of a larger yoga of humanity or superhumanity, this is the social background, the social transformation that Sri Aurobindo envisaged based upon a spiritual consciousness, that the realized selves, individually and then collectively, could stretch out into India and spark that awareness in other zones of development, and then proceed into the rest of the world. Always, and that of course is phase three, always indeed, it is the higher power that acts. Our sense of personal effort and aspiration comes from the attempt of the egoistic mind to identify itself in a wrong and imperfect way with the workings of the divine force. It persists in applying to experience on a supernormal plane the ordinary terms of mentality which it applies to its normal experiences in the world. In the world, we act with the sense of egoism. We claim the universal forces that work in us as our own. We claim, as the effect of our personal will, wisdom, force, virtue, the selective, formative, progressive action of the transcendent in this frame of mind, life, and body. Enlightenment brings to us the knowledge that the ego is only an instrument. We begin to perceive and feel that these things are our own in the sense that they belong to our supreme and integral self, one with the transcendent, not to the instrumental ego. It's interesting that when you read the dialogue between Sanat Sujata and Dhritarashtra, he is making these very points to the king. Our limitations and distortions are our contribution to the working. The true power in it is the divine's. And again, this is a phrase that we find appearing in somewhat different words in the book, The Mother. When the human ego realizes that its will is a tool, its wisdom, ignorance, and childishness, its power, an infant's groping, its virtue, a pretentious impurity, and learns to trust itself to that which transcends it, that is its salvation. The apparent freedom and self-assertion of our personal being to which we are so profoundly attached conceal a most pitiable subjection to 1,000 suggestions, impulsions, forces which we have made extraneous to our little person. Our ego, boasting of freedom, is at every moment the slave, toy, and puppet of countless beings, powers, forces, influences, and universal nature. The self-abnegation of the ego in the divine is its self-fulfillment. Its surrender to that which transcends it is its liberation from bonds and limits, and its perfect freedom. So it isn't the extinguishing of the ego in the lower nature, but the lifting of its consciousness, the consciousness inherent behind the ego, into that that permits... There's a word for it. It's not sublimation, but it is the same thing. It is the character, taking on the character of the divine as one rises. But still, in the practical development, each of the three stages has its necessity and utility and must be given its time or its place. It will not do. It cannot be safe or effective to begin with the last and the highest alone. It would not be the right course either to leap prematurely from one to another. It's interesting that Sri Aurobindo makes this point, and of course he made it in his letters on yoga as well, because there is a sort of haste in the human taste for things to race ahead and to leap from the normal egoistic life into the supramental consciousness. Why bother with all the rest of it? Let's get started and change the world. He dealt with that within his ashram, in fact. There were people that were considered to be leading lights of the ashram at an early phase who sort of fell from yoga, brashta, because they felt that they were ready then and there to carry forward with the supramental evolution and not have to wait for Sri Aurobindo and the mother who were being tardy in catching up with them, the great seeker in front of them. So actually, it led to the ruination of several people's yoga to have such an unwise and unbalanced ambition. You have to attend to the grades. You have to assume the rhythm of life and let the divine, invite the divine into the nature to lift you up. It isn't your choice. You can't storm the gates of heaven. There's this wonderful Vedic hymn, which is a colloquy between Agastya, the great sage, and Indra. And he's trying, in a sense, to burst past Indra, and Indra is saying, no, you can't come yet. You're not ready. And Agastya is saying, why do you? You're my friend. Why are you stopping me? Because you have to be in harmony with the right movement. And so then Agastya finally gets it and says, ah, and now I will work in harmony with you, and is invited into the divine consciousness. And Indra represents the divine mind, so it's an illumination of enlightenment that the Veda speaks about that's consonant with what we would be talking about in Vedantic practice centuries later. It would not be the right course either to leap prematurely from one to another. For even if from the beginning we recognize in mind and heart the Supreme, there are elements of the nature which long prevent the recognition from becoming realization. So if the regular course of yoga is guided by the divine presence, not by the gusto of the ego's will, we have also to recognize that we can have an insight or a first recognition of the truths behind the cosmos before we have the realization. There are different grades. The insight leads to the realization. But if you followed meditation practices around the world, there is such a thing as called beginner's samadhi, where you have an initial experience where the reality of the ego cracks in half and the subjective awareness within moves into alignment and even to a kind of fusion with the object that you were seeking, be it the reality behind the mantra or behind the visualized form. And that first burst of unification is thought to be the thing. I've arrived, now I can quit, I have realization. But it's the first insight, isn't the final insight. So one continues to work and to solidify, to greaten, amplify, deepen. But without realization, our mental belief cannot become a dynamic reality. It is still only a figure of knowledge, not a living truth, an idea, not yet a power. And even if realization has begun, it may be dangerous to imagine or to assume too soon that we are altogether in the hands of the Supreme or are acting as his instrument. That assumption may introduce a calamitous falsity. It may produce a helpless inertia, or magnifying the movements of the ego with the divine name, it may disastrously distort and ruin the whole course of the yoga. There is a period, more or less prolonged, of internal effort and struggle in which the individual will has to reject the darkness and distortions of the lower nature and to put itself resolutely or vehemently on the side of the divine light. So there comes a choice, and you have to be aware, and you have to have the power of discrimination, viveka, with you, to go along with the utsaha, the enthusiastic force of will. The mental energies, the heart's emotions, the vital desires, the very physical being have to be compelled into the right attitude or trained to admit an answer to the right influences. It is only then, only when this has been truly done, that the surrender of the lower to the higher can be effected, because the sacrifice has become acceptable. This is similar to that tantric process. By superimposition of the divine nature upon the human, that the human being is subordinated to the divine being. Remember, Sri Aurobindo's method is one that begins with the Vedantic knowledge but proceeds by the tantric method. The personal will of the sadhaka has first to seize on the egoistic energies and turn them towards the light and the right. Once turned, he has still to train them to recognize that always, always to accept, always to follow that. Progressing, he learns, still using the personal will, personal effort, personal energies, to employ them as representatives of the higher power and in conscious obedience to the higher influence. Progressing yet farther, his will, effort, energy become no longer personal and separate, but activities of that higher power and influence at work in the individual. But there is still a sort of gulf or distance which necessitates an obscure process of transit. Not always accurate, sometimes even very distorting, between the divine origin and the emerging human current. At the end of the process, with the progressive disappearance of egoism and impurity and ignorance, this last separation is removed. All in the individual becomes the divine working, sayujya. Note how frequently in this paragraph he uses the term progress. It is progressive, not sudden. This is not insight only, but has to proceed gradually to become active in the nature, convincing one part of the being after the other to accept the divine influence, to accommodate it, to be directed by it, and then to fuse into it. So it is a long process. It begins with the realization, yes, but the realization leading to transformation is effortful and is progressive. You don't get there all at once. So I think it's a good place to pause for this evening. We'll take up another section of the chapter, the Four Aids. By the way, this would have been around the time that the mother and her then husband, Paul Richard, were receiving word that he would be required to come back to France. So it's interesting that this wonderful chapter got written just before their departure. In a sense, it's good company. It's satsang for them to carry with them back to France and then from there to Japan. Calling attention to the inner reality. The word is inside. The force that activates your yoga is from the divine. He will say that the guru is he who speaks and guides from within. The world teacher, Jagadguru, is there inside you, wherever you are, if you're in France, if later you're in Japan. And finally, it just takes time. And she will know that well. She will learn that and teach that to us. So here's a section from Savitri I think you might like. This is in Book 2. The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 12, The Heavens of the Ideal. This is on page 279. On the other side of the eternal stairs, the mighty kingdoms of the deathless flame aspired to reach the being's absolutes. Out of the sorrow and darkness of the world, out of the depths where life and thought are tombed, lonely mounts up to heaven the deathless flame. In a veiled nature's hallowed secrecies, it burns forever on the altar mind. Its priests, the souls of dedicated gods, humanity, its house of sacrifice. Once kindled, never can its flaming cease. A fire along the mystic paths of earth, it rises through the mortal's hemisphere, till borne by runners of the day and dusk, it enters the occult eternal light and clambers, whitening to the invisible throne. Its worlds are steps of an ascending force. A dream of giant contours, titan lines, homes of unfallen and illumined might, heavens of unchanging good, pure and unborn, heights of the grandeur of truth's ageless ray. As in a symbol sky, they start to view and call our souls into a vaster air. On their summits, they bear up the sleepless flame, dreaming of a mysterious beyond, transcendent of the paths of fate and time. They point above themselves with index peaks through a pale sapphire ether of God-mind, toward some gold infinite's apocalypse. A thunder rolling mid the hills of God, tireless, severe is their tremendous voice. Exceeding us, to exceed ourselves they call, and bid us rise incessantly above. Far from our eager reach those summits live, too lofty for our mortal strength and height. Hardly in a dire ecstasy of toil, climbed by the spirit's naked athlete will. Austere, intolerant, they claim from us efforts too lasting for our mortal nerve, our hearts cannot cleave to, nor our flesh support. Only the eternal strength in us can dare to attempt the immense adventure of that climb and the sacrifice of all we cherish here. Our human knowledge is a candle burnt on a dim altar to a sun-vast truth. Man's virtue, a coarse-spun, ill-fitting dress, apparels wooden images of good. Passionate and blinded, bleeding, stained with mire, his energy stumbles towards a deathless force. An imperfection dogs our highest strength. Portions and pale reflections are our share. Happy the worlds that have not felt our fall, where will is one with truth and good with power. Impoverished not by earth mind's indigence, they keep God's natural breath of mightiness, his bare, spontaneous, swift intensities. There is his great, transparent mirror, self. and there his sovereign autarky of bliss, in which immortal natures have their part, heirs and co-sharers of divinity. So, namaste.